Generative modeling is sort of a subset of machine learning, very broadly. You know, you have artificial intelligence, you have some sort of machine learning, you have neural networks. Generative modeling is a strategy which has a lot of overlaps with quantum physics, which is why we're talking about it in this course, and has a lot of kind of analogies with the lectures you just heard on tensor networks and so on. And so I want to start this lecture series by maybe talking about kind of the general setting of generative modeling, and you know how it relates to tensor networks, or how we're inspired by tensor networks, perhaps. And then we'll get into some very concrete examples that I hope will lead into your tutorial, which is it Wednesday or Thursday?
Wednesday.
Okay, so which starts on Wednesday on this topic. So very roughly, since it's your, I think, first machine learning lecture in this series, I just want to say a couple words about machine learning strategies, very generally, which are very much a data-driven enterprise. Of course, you know, machine learning, big data, they kind of go, in many cases, hand in hand. But, you know, we're really interested in these lectures, I think, in thinking about data-driven strategies in quantum physics, and especially now in the age of sort of, you know, fairly large quantum devices coming out that can give us, you know, very clean projective measurements of a quantum state. So underlying everything that I'm talking about, I want you to imagine that you're either an experimentalist or you're working with experimentalists, and you're getting data that's being produced by a quantum computer. And the kind of core theme about what I'm going to talk about is sort of how do you leverage that data to provide value for some problem of interest. Okay, so how does machine learning sort of fit into that? There's typically two types of strategies. There's many more, but you know, very roughly, machine learning strategies could fall under discriminative. Discriminative means that you're discriminating something. It's really that you're making predictions on data. So supervised learning, if you've heard of supervised versus unsupervised, maybe this is kind of another way of saying supervised learning. Supervised implies that you have a data set that's being produced, and you have some machine, which I'll talk about what the machine is, and then you have a supervisor which tells you this is a picture of a cat, a picture of a dog, or something like that. And so the goal of discriminative learning, in some sense, is to make predictions on unseen data. And again, I'm just setting the stage. So you imagine you have data coming into a machine, and you're doing something to train that machine or to learn. That's what the L is in machine learning. You're learning something. And then you want to make predictions on data that isn't part of the training set. That's a very simple way of thinking about it, right? So if you train a machine on all possible pictures of cats and dogs on the internet, and then you give it a new picture of a dog, a successful discriminative task or outcome would be a label on that picture. Yes, this new picture that's not part of the training set, so it's unseen, is either a cat or a dog. And I just mentioned that to separate it from another strategy, which is more related to generative models, which I'm just going to call generative. A generative strategy, which is a subset of all the tasks that we call unsupervised learning. Which means that there's no supervisor that's applying labels or something like that. Is this the front board? Yes. So the task for generative models is different. You're not making predictions on data. You're not labeling it cat, dog, or something like that. You're really trying to explain, in some loose sense, how the data was generated. And that's number one, explain how it was generated. And number two, generate new unseen data. Explain. So this could be as simple as learning a likelihood that, you know, or a probability distribution function underlying the data. And that's kind of the setting we'll take. Explain how a data set was generated and, you know, generate. I should say, I'm using generated a lot here. Maybe produced for this one. Was produced. Now I'm gonna use generate, you know. Generate from the machine, right? New unseen data. Unseen is the same context as what I'm using here. It could be, you know, it should be data that hasn't been part of the original training set. And, you know, when machine learning strategies are successful in doing this, we say they generalize well. Okay, so in both of these cases, the idea that your data set is sort of incomplete in some sense, and you're constructing a machine learning model that generalizes well, underlies all of this. So in the unsupervised case, you know, the generative case that we're going to be interested in for these lectures, there's many architectures out there in the world that you've probably encountered that can do generative modeling or generative machine learning tasks. So, you know, GANs were a famous one, generative adversarial networks, which gave us deep fakes, right? So whenever you see an image on the internet, especially an image that is, you know, or a video of somebody talking and it's a deep fake and blah, 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 this is typically produced by some sort of generative model. In the old days, GANs were, and it's not even that long ago, you know, GANs were the most common, I'd say, deep fake for images. Now we have all sorts of generative models related to not just, you know, images and videos, but also text, and so diffusion models. DALL-E, how do you spell that? Is it A or E? I don't know. D-A-L-L-E. DALL-E is a diffusion model. We had lectures on this, on these models in our group a few weeks ago. I won't get into them. ChatGPT, so any of the sort of GPT models that come out of OpenAI and so on. GPT. You know, these are all, as the name suggests, generative pre-trained models, okay? So anything that generates text and you know, undergraduate essays and so on. So one thing to note about these models is they represent, you know, something like a probability distribution that I'll get into, you know, with parameters. So just like you heard about with tensor networks, and I want to make the connection in a few different places, we typically parameterize the state in some way. And those parameters, which are, you know, weights and biases or something that I'll define, you know, is sort of where all the action is. Something like GPT-3 had like 100 billion parameters. And although GPT-4 hasn't been released, we're talking about over a trillion parameters in these models. And, you know, a huge amount of training. You know, so over, I heard in Aspen at a conference, a couple months ago, that modern generative models are being trained on 10 to the 23 floating points per week, or something like that. So one of the underlying themes with these generative models that I think we're getting into now, which should interest physicists, is the idea that we're scaling. Okay, we're at the stage now where these models are sort of, you know, crossing the threshold from microscopic to macroscopic. And that's always been a dream for especially people in our field, condensed matter physicists, to somehow have models or ways to quantify emergence.
We just have an online question for you.
Shoot.
What is a floating point?
It's like, it's a real number represented in the computer. Okay, so flops, floating point operations per second, is a common way of, I guess, quantifying, you know, how many real operations a computer can do per second. Somebody answer better than that.
I think the follow-up question is now in bits. Like, can you answer using bits?
Not off the top of my head. But so, like, what's the representation for?
It's 64 bits.
Six, yeah, I was just going to say common six, common float 64 would be 64 bits. So you that times Avogadro's number, it's still Avogadro's number. I have no independent confirmation of that result, by the way. It's just something I heard during a lunch break. So, but it got me interested. So, why are we interested in generative models in quantum physics? So I just hope to kind of motivate a few points of interest and maybe some discussion. So first off, you know, these machine learning strategies are centered around models, and although I haven't really defined it yet, the models for us are typically parameterizations of either a probability distribution or a quantum state or something like that. And there's a real specific reason to use modeling of parameterized models. And let me just say, at the core is a model of a distribution, a probability distribution function, which I'll probably just call, I'll just say distribution. That you hope can model high dimensional data of a probability distribution, a model for high D data. And that higher dimension could be, an analogy to kind of a many-body Hilbert space, if you're thinking about the quantum many-body problem, right? So you have some sort of exponentially growing, say, Hilbert space, for a quantum computer with n qubits or something like that. And so one of the questions is, why do you need a model? It's like the zeroth order question. Why don't we just take, the data from a quantum computer, say, and just construct a representation of the probability distribution from data, right, without somehow worrying about a parameterization? And this, this is one, answering the question why you're interested in generative models, and why not, for example, just take a bunch of data. I'm going to define this more rigorously when we start talking about specific models. But just imagine I have a data vector. Which I could approximate with a histogram. So the size of my data vector, each data vector, I should maybe do this now, but so this is the size of my data set. I'm just really defining the histogram. This is dumb. So for every vector, I'm going to label them k in the data set. I'm defining the probability or the likelihood of a vector x with this delta function. Real simple. So why don't we always just do that? And what does this mean? It means, you have some probability distribution, and you're binning, and you run through the data set, right? That's of a certain size. Maybe there's 1,000 pictures of dogs that you've got off the internet. And you want to say, what is the probability distribution of all possible dogs? Well, okay, how do you do that? You take all of your dog pictures, and you start to say, calculate, the likelihood through the histogram. So you start building up a histogram, and maybe you have more probability here. So you're kind of like building, all these bins should be the same size. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm imagining doing my 10,000 shots and building up a histogram like this. And you can say, okay, that's an approximation of my probability distribution without any parameterization, just from, you know, counting, you know, the occurrence of each one of these vectors or something like that. And so sometimes I'll call that, you know, P data X. There's no model, there's no parameters, you just have this, you know, this bump. So the philosophy behind a model is about, you know, what's the best use of that data? Is the best use of that data, you know, just building up a raw histogram? Or if I have some inductive bias, or if I have some, you know, or some priors, some prior knowledge that I can bake into a model, quote unquote, into the parameterization, do I gain something? So for example, if I had reason to believe that I was drawing this data from a Gaussian distribution, right, wouldn't it be a lot better to parameterize, I'm going to use small p, lambda is some parameters, I'll say this a lot, you know, with some sort of, let's see if I can get this wrong, 2 pi, so it's got to be, oh my god, what am I doing? Is there a 1 half here? So it's x minus mu over sigma here, right? Squared. So now I've parameterized my models where my parameters are this, the mean and the standard deviation. Mean, standard deviation.
So lambda is a tuple of mean and standard deviation?
In this case, yes, but more generally, it'll be a whole bunch of different parameters, okay? This is a two-parameter parameterization, but it could be n parameters, some higher number.
Another online question. Can you say a bit about the expected dimension of the data vector?
Could be anything, honestly. We're going to deal with binary data. So we're going to deal with projective measurements of a quantum computer, which come out as 0 or 1, okay? So I've kept
am I able to speak? Hi, Roger.
Hi.
This is Marina.
Hi.
I was just wondering, because the parameter space has a trillion dimensions, as you're exploring it to make a prediction and you have a data vector, I can't see the board, but I think it goes labeled by K. So K would go up to a trillion dimensions, correct? In the generative model, since that's the number of degrees of freedom or number of parameters. Am I understanding this correctly?
K goes
your
from
data vector.
1 to the size of the data set.
Which is order 10 to the 12.
The data set is how many shots you produce from your measurement. So if you measure, you know, if you scrape the internet for 1,000 pictures of dogs, it's 1,000. And if you get 1,000 shots out of your quantum computer, K is 1,000 there. So then you would only have 1,000 elements in this bin, okay?
Uh-huh.
That's what I'm saying. And the parameters-
So you're not yet the tokens.
I'm not yet there. So I'm not yet there.
Yes.
So I'll get there. So then what I'm saying is, if I have a two-parameter model, you know, it's always better to fit that two-parameter model to get a functional, you know, functional form for your probability distribution. It's always better, I think, in this case, than just trying to, you know, build up the histogram from 1,000 shots. And what I've tried to illustrate here is you're missing bins, you're missing information, right? If you try to calculate the likelihood, you know, in this representation from something you have no data on, you're going to get it wrong, right? But if you use that data to just fit two parameters in a Gaussian, and you come up to that same point here, and you ask, what's the likelihood of vector x? Well, now you have a model for it. You have a functional dependence that'll give you, hopefully, the right answer.
So in order to go from this data on the left to the model on the right, you still have to have some sort of reasonable justification for assuming it's a Gaussian.
That's the bias. That's the inductive bias of your model. Okay. All models have some inductive bias. This one's obvious. You're like, okay, I'm gonna assume it's a Gaussian, right? But in general, it's not obvious. And so the strategy is to build models that have an adjustable number of parameters. maybe that amount of parameters can be systematically increased for more complex or more, you know, higher dimensional state spaces or something like that. And that's where neural networks come in, okay? By the way, it's also where tensor networks come in, right? You're trying to represent, say, the ground state of a wave function. You know, the parameters or the number of parameters is related to your bond dimension, right? And you can systematically increase the bond dimension of your tensor network to represent more complex, you know, or more higher dimensional wave functions. So very generally you want...
Can we... Sorry, Roger, just one more question. Can we think of inductive bias as correlations between the parameters? So sort of degeneracies or a reduction of the number of dimensionality in the Fisher matrix kind of data analysis?
I would
Is
say
that more or less?
Yeah, I would say that's fair, yeah. You're trying to, you know,
thank you.
You hope that
reduce.
You have, yeah, you hope that you have a kind of efficient representation in that bias model. So, I mean, maybe that's a good point. So generally you want... I would say models that have an efficient representation. I'll say that have So what's efficient mean? I mean, that's very much what I think you're learning from Martin in some sense. In a tensor network case, we know that if, your wave function, ground state wave function is represented by an area law, then there's a efficient representation as a tensor network, which means the number of parameters scales sub-exponentially. Is that right? Did I get that right? Sub-exponentially with the number of qubits. Okay. Question?
I think it's maybe more just a comment, but so what you were saying on that previous board is basically the old frequentist versus Bayesian approach in statistics?
Well, I don't have an explicit, prior that I'm modeling. So, I mean, I'm not much of a Bayesian person. But Bayesians, you're always modeling priors. Here, I don't have an explicit, conditional probability distribution. So I'd say it's still frequentist, but I mean, I'm kind of speaking to the physicists. What do? You take your physical biases or your physical priors and you bake them into models. And I think tensor networks is a perfect representation of that. I'd say a tensor network is still not a Bayesian representation of a probability distribution explicitly, but it certainly has what I would call an inductive bias towards area law entangled quantum states.
I mean, if you would like to be a Bayesian approach, and you would, the lambda and mu and sigma would need to have like probabilities by themselves. So.
Right.
Otherwise, it wouldn't be a Bayesian.
Yeah, exactly. So you can make things Bayesian in that sense for sure. But so what do we want? We want efficient representations, and I'll get into kind of the efficiency of neural networks and so on. We want an efficient learning procedure. This one's important. So I'll get back to, in tensor networks, you have a singular value decomposition for a 1D MPS. It's a deterministic optimization that tells you the optimum parameters to represent the ground state of your wave function, right? We're not that lucky in machine learning. We have very much heuristic learning procedures that have been developed over decades, essentially. But if you can't learn those two parameters or those huge amount of neural network parameters, then it doesn't matter how good your representation is, right? And so this gets into, the complexity of optimization and things like that, which is a very interesting field, I think, and there's a lot of unknowns. You want a way of calculating, again, an efficient way of calculating properties. From the model, right? So it's almost obvious in physics what that is. You might want to know an energy or a magnetization or a susceptibility or a specific heat or something like that, right? So again, you can imagine having an efficient representation, an efficient learning procedure, and not being able to calculate anything. Although I think a lot of times these two things go hand in hand. Are you going to talk about PEPs at all?
Just briefly.
So in the two-dimensional tensor network we call PEPS, we have an efficient representation, but correct me if I'm wrong, we don't have sort of a generic efficient way of, say, calculating like an inner product or something like that, right? Doing a contraction.
Okay, but not exactly, right? So right. The way we do it is efficient, but it's not in the sense that it's polynomial, but it's not exact.
Well, nothing here will be exact in these lectures. So, and I think we want very, very generally the ability to generalize the unseen data. And I think that model, again, if I want to know the likelihood of this bin here, of this vector x, right, then the model is going to tell me roughly the correct value if I do, you know, if I fit the parameters correctly. So again, in this really simple example, we're, I think, easily able to generalize, but it's certainly one of the things we want. So for quantum systems, really all we're doing is taking the concept of likelihoods or probability distributions and models, and we're extending that to the case where we have wave functions with complex amplitudes or density matrices. And I'll say simply, because it's not simple at all, extend. I'd say they're pretty much core machine learning concepts to, you know, a parameterized, say, wave function or a density matrix. So that's one of the things we'll get into sort of next lecture. Okay, I'm talking really slow. So I had a few things I wanted to say about tensor networks, but I might just say them and not write too many of them. So one of the core motivations for, you know, constructing new generative models, which are very much, you know, influenced by industry. So I mentioned ChatGPT and GANs and diffusion models for a reason. Because in this field, what we've been doing is we've been watching, you know, industry developments. And, you know, these are very much industry tools. When we talk about a deep fake for an image, or if we talk about natural language processing, of course, they're natural phenomena that are very important for humans, but they also have industry applications and industry incentive to build. So very much the field of machine learning has been incentivized by industry applications. So when we start to adapt these technologies to quantum physics, you know, I think we can take a lot of inspiration from tensor networks. Which are often used not in a data-driven setting. I'll get to that. They're typically, you're given a Hamiltonian or you're given a quantum circuit and you're trying to simulate it, right? So that Hamiltonian typically drives the optimization, say, which is the learning procedure, if you will, you know, for that representation. But they can also be tooled to, you know, do things like tomography. So they're very much, you know, typically Hamiltonian driven. That's the optimization, that's the learning, but can be data-driven. And they're very powerful, I'd say, learning models or learning onsots in the data-driven case. The onsots, you know, for, you know, the efficient representation very much comes from the assumption of area law physics. And so physics gives a lot of input into, I guess, why tensor networks work, or, you know, the cases where they work. So, you know, the area, the entanglement scaling like L to the D minus one, where I imagine the entanglement between a bipartition A and B with some characteristic length scale L, very much baked into the DNA of tensor networks. Let me move this up.
Roger, one more question. The Hamiltonian here, you mean in the parameter exploration sense, or you mean Hamiltonian as in Lagrangian?
I mean, something that governs the interactions of the physical system of interest.
Okay, yeah, it's the latter. Thank you.
So I won't talk about Hamiltonian-driven optimization or Hamiltonian-driven learning. Although any of the, maybe Mohammed will. I'm going to guess he will. But all the setting I'm going to talk about is very much data-driven. But I think the point is, be aware that, you know, we have very successful architectures, which you're learning about, which are very much physically motivated, you know, related to tensor networks. And of course, okay, so one of the issues with tensor networks in this Hamiltonian-driven setting is that it's a challenge to optimize them in dimensions higher than one. And so one of the motivations for looking at machine learning models right now, I think for many of us, is to try to find some onsets and a learning heuristic that gives us good results in higher dimensions. Okay, so it's you know, one of the motivations. Finding a machine learning model that outperforms tensor networks in D greater than one. That's a tall order, honestly. I think almost all state-of-the-art results for, you know, complex quantum systems, you know, the record is held by tensor networks. There, I know a few kind of edge cases where, and Mohammed might talk about them, where architectures like recurrent neural networks win out. But very generally, you know, it's been a holy grail since the 90s, I would say, to find something that beats DMRG in higher dimensions. 1990s. So I think that's something important to think about. You know, Steve White, in 1992, you know, first invented the DMRG. It's been 30 years. There's lots of articles online now, you know, 30 years of DMRG, how much it changed the world, and so on. DMRG, density matrix renormalization group, you know, it's the standard bearer for all quantum simulations that don't have the sign, or that have the sign problem, sorry, that can't be attacked by quantum Monte Carlo. And, you know, the history of DMRG and its eventual evolution into the field of tensor networks is I'd say, another very important motivation for us. Steve White was very much developing, in one way of looking at, a heuristic algorithm. You know, he had a way of patching together, you know, a system and an environment and trying to make the wave function, obey boundary conditions. And he came up with the modern architecture of, you know, density matrix renormalization group, you know, very heuristically, I would say, and which then motivated a large theoretical body of work on the subject of area laws and entanglement and tensor networks and so on. So that kind of interplay between heuristics and theory, you know, going back, you know, theory informs developments of the code, if you will, or of the algorithms. And algorithm performance very much, you know, iterates to inform the next generation of theory. Until tensor network theory now is very well developed and has applications all over the place, like, you know, the very notion of it from qubit and you know, the idea that if you could, you know, arrange a bunch of qubits with a certain Hamiltonian and have space-time emerge, or the ADS-CFT where you have, you know, something like a MERA, so maybe a, you know, a tensor network structure that's motivated by conformal invariance or something like that, you know, as a descriptor for a long wavelength approach to critical, you know, physics, I think is very well developed and should be a motivation. So what are, in the machine learning context, right, we're very much at that first stage of heuristics. We're like where Steve White was in 1992, except there's a massive community of us, and we have all sorts of great libraries, like, you know, which have been developed by the machine learning industry. So imagine how much Steve White could have done if he had iTensor in 1992, right? Which he never. He was writing his own C++ codes. So I feel like that's, in some sense, where we are with these machine learning generative models. We have demonstrably good heuristics that are coming to us from industry. And I would point to, you know, transformers. I didn't mention them. I'll mention them in a minute. which are the main element of these kind of GPT type models, which have demonstrated scaling. Like I mentioned, a trillion parameters and 10 to the 23, say, you know, size of the training set. That's the elements K that were being fed into that trained models. So we basically have existence proof for large scalable models. And now the task for us in some sense is to, as physicists, think about the applications for these in physics. And as we develop these heuristics, can we develop something like a foundational theory, right? What makes these machine learning generative models tick? What are their pros? What are their cons? What is the basis of their kind of amazing performance, I would say, in industry? So very much a prime motivator there. I'm going to move on to some more technical stuff now. Any questions on why I'm here talking to you? Vass Grant.
I keep hearing language models and transformer, attention is the key and so on.
Right.
So how will you put it in the language of tensor networks?
So Mohammed will answer this question for you. So in lecture 4 on Thursday, Mohammed will introduce what's called a recurrent neural network, which is a, in its simplest iteration, it's a one-dimensional neural network that takes a hidden state, which encodes the correlations and passes it in one dimension. It's very much like, you know, an analogy to how an MPS, takes correlations in one dimension and efficiently handles them. What a transformer is with its attention mechanism is it gets rid, in some sense, of that one-dimensional path for correlations to be passed. So in some sense, it's a higher dimensional version in that analogy. But I'm very much setting you guys up, I think, to maybe understand Mohammed's RNN architectures, which he's developed over the last 5 years. And then hopefully, you'll leapfrog into things like transformers and other models in the future. So I'll get there.
Roger, I have a question before you proceed to more technical or to more specific.
Okay.
From a physics, theoretical physics point of view, you were mentioning possibly 10 to the 23 size of the training set.
Right.
As theoretical physicists, and you know that we have 10 to the 124 entropy in the universe given by the cosmic horizon of the dark energy in natural units, say. We are still not wanting this 10 to the 23 to approach 10 to the 124 at any point, right? Do you agree with that as a physicist?
I have to think about that. I have to think about whether I agree.
Oh, please
with
do.
That.
Yeah. Please do.
I mean, why not, you know, create a computer out of all matter on Earth and start processing data? It's like the information death of the world. And then maybe you can approach those types of numbers. I don't know.
I mean, but the black hole information number would have. Are we taking that as a limit on how much information can be generated by the models?
I think that's
something that I have been struggling with.
I think it's a fair upper limit. Yeah, absolutely.
It's an upper limit, right?
Yeah, I'd say that's pretty fair.
Globally speaking, if these numbers start approaching anything like the black hole number, we should intervene, I believe, as physicists, or say, hello, that's the black hole entropy that you're approaching, and maybe we should double check the dimensionality of the parameter space, like correlations between parameters. Maybe that's not that high number of degrees of freedom.
I mean, I think it's important to distinguish between the size of the training set, which I was alluding to, and the number of parameters. So of course, training time, you know, could approach infinity. I mean, on all, even if you take a quantum computer that has n qubits, right? You know, the size of the state space is 2 to the n there. It gets very large very fast. So for, 256 qubits, it's 10 to the 80. Again, that's more of a question of training resources than number of parameters in the model. The number of parameters in modern language models, LLMs, is more like a trillion.
Yeah.
And what state of the art tensor networks?
Well, I've done like 600 billion.
600 billion. So close to a trillion, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's kind of a David's face. That's pretty impressive. That's like GPT-3.
I don't know.
Can we have the face? Can we have the face?
Why not? Why not? This is where we are today with modern computers, right? I think we can train a trillion parameter machines.
It costs like, I don't know, like $40,000 to train.
Exactly. And the point also with the large language models, it's really now the bottleneck is the training cost, right? How many cycles can we afford to push training data sets into these models? And that's very much the calculus of the large language models coming out in industry, right? They're GPT-3 costs $20 million to train, right? They don't release how much GPT-4 costs, but you know, you're getting up to $100 million to train, right? These are now, you know, emergent language models that basically need industry to train them.
Need a country.
Yeah, you need a country. It's like, you know, the old story of the critical mass calculations for nuclear weapons, right? People realize you have to industrialize your entire country in order to make enrich enough uranium to build a bomb. So some people thought it was impossible, but America industrialized their entire country and produced enough uranium. So we're at that stage now with large language models, right? The amount of carbon output for training GPT-4, I mean, who knows what it is, but we're in a world of finite resources, so. But you know, that's an ethics question.
So, as physicists, since you were a physicist, you do agree that we must not, realistically, in the world of gravity and dark energy, we have to put a cap on that black hole number,
sure.
If those numbers start to be approached and or claimed to be approached.
I mean, I think we're so far from that point that I haven't worried about it yet. So that's why I don't
have
a great answer.
Oh, that's good. I like that. Yeah, that's good. Thank you. I want to hear that.
So let me start with just a real quick taxonomy of generative models. And it's a bit outdated, so I just want to say a couple points. But Ian Goodfellow, who is the inventor of GANs, had a nice sort of review on the archive, which was from NeurIPS 2017, 0016. Sorry about that. You can find it, which broke generative models up into several different categories. I think the most important for Ian's perspective was the difference between what he called explicit density and implicit density models. So that's the highest level. Implicit versus explicit. Implicit density models, have parameters. These are all parameterized models. But in an implicit density model, you don't have a direct, you know, you don't directly, I'd say, interact with the probability distribution. So it's kind of a vague notion, but what you do is you basically don't have an explicit parameterization. So we're only gonna deal with explicit density models. Of the probability distribution P of X, okay? And this lambda, you know, counts whatever it was, it was delta and mu, but in generally it'll be all the weights and biases of a neural network, okay? So an explicit density model has this direct parameterization. The implicit density models have no direct parameterization. And you typically interact with the models, through some indirect means. So, by some indirect So GANs are the most important example. And I'm mentioning them now because I won't mention them again. Generative adversarial networks. Remember, you basically have, you have data, you have a generator. Is that what it's called? Which takes some random input. The data and the generator go into a discriminator, which I assume is what it's called. And then that discriminator feeds back into the, I should have left more room, feeds back into the generator as part of training. So it's trying to distinguish between real cats and dog pictures and cats and dog pictures that are generated by some machine. And that discriminator uses the false instances or whatever you want to call it to train the generator until the generator gets better and better. But so there's all sorts of architectures that look like this that don't have explicit parameterizations of a probability distribution. Maybe autoencoders is another another one. So I'm only going to work on the explicit density side. And on the explicit density side, Goodfellow talks about tractable and intractable density models. So tractable versus intractable. And I want us to think about what these words mean, because this will be a theme for the rest of my lectures and for Mohammed's lectures. The difference between tractable and intractable density estimation and density learning. So on the tractable side, all, I think, of the modern architectures that are being scaled to date, which include recurrent neural networks, transformers, and I think diffusion models, are considered tractable density models. But they're actually a fairly recent invention. And what I would encourage you as physicists to think about, the tractability is being in some sense related to the normalization or the tractability of the normalization of the representation or something like that. So I'm just saying words, but we'll narrow down. So on the tractable side, we have things like any autoregressive model. Mohammed will define maybe I'll define autoregressive models when we deal with the NADs. Autoregressive models are their sequence maps. And the basic idea is that a joint probability distribution, if it's being modeled, is broken up into, say I have the outcome of a number of qubits. It's broken up into the product rule of probabilities. And it's a very important and very general expression for tractable density models. So we're going to see this again and again, but the distribution, which is the goal of my generative modeling procedure, in autoregressive models is broken up into the probability of outcomes on qubit 1, then the probability of outcomes on qubit 2 conditioned on the outcome of 1, 3 conditioned on everything previous, and so on. Okay, we'll explore that in detail. But as far as I know, it's one of the basic models underlying tractable density generative learning. By the way, an NPS is a autoregressive model. So if you want to produce samples from an NPS in a tensor network formalism, you do it through some procedure that is like this. So it tells you, the reason I mentioned it first is it tells you something about tensor networks, I think. So in these autoregressive models, again, Mohammed will talk about RNNs. This is Thursday and Friday. NADs, I'll get to that on Wednesday. Transformers, etc. So what I'm trying to do in partially in these lectures is build us up towards this idea that you know we're going to start thinking about these sequence mapping procedure and these autoregressive models that have become so important in industry. But before we do that, I want to talk about the intractable branch. So the intractable branch were the first generative models that were considered by machine learning people and physicists, largely in the 80s. So I'll talk a little bit about that. John Hopfield was an important one. So Hopfield models. Restricted Bolson machines, which will be the bulk of my lectures. RBMs. What's another? I can't think of another one off the top of my head. So I guess any energy-based model. And we're going to define what that means. I'm going to do that right now. So I'm going to define your first energy-based model, which is actually going to be Hopfield's model from the 1980s. And I'm going to develop from that intuition, the theory of the restricted Bolson machines. And we're going to see exactly how the intractability of it. So think about think about an energy-based model where I have P 1 over Z e to the minus E. So if I have a probability distribution that's modeled by a Boltzmann distribution, as the name suggests in many of these models, I typically don't know the partition function. That's a classic intractable problem in statistical mechanics. Okay, so at zeroth order, in some perturbative expansion of what you know, at zeroth order, intractable models are intractable because we don't have a knowledge of the partition function. What that means is if I want to throw a likelihood, if I want to calculate the likelihood for some vector x here, right, I can calculate the relative weight or something like that, like I would do in Monte Carlo, but I can't just calculate the normalized probability distribution. So just by that very intuition, you see that intractable models typically need some sort of like Markov chain Monte Carlo for sampling. So typically. Markov chain.
Quickly, so the tractable models are not going to use MC-MC?
Correct.
Okay.
Sorry.
Markov chain, Monte Carlo. And I'll get into it more. Because in a autoregressive model, you have a breakup of the joint distribution into this product of normalized conditionals, no Markov chain Monte Carlo. So that's another underlying theme that we're going to talk about when Mohammed starts lecturing you guys. Because if you require Markov chain Monte Carlo, you typically produce correlated samples. And the fact that it's not IID, the distribution coming out of the models. And so typically that Markov chain has some sort of memory. They call it an autocorrelation time. And that autocorrelation time significantly reduces the efficiency, I think, if you will, of sampling from these intractable models. So that's one hypothesis that's come out recently in the performance differences between intractable models and the autoregressive models that are now being scaled in industry. Although I gotta say, there's not complete consensus that this is the underlying reason for the performance differences. That's something you should look at with a critical eye. So for example, Jan LeCun, let me just finish. So Jan LeCun really believes that we have to abandon autoregressive models and get back into energy-based models. So that's something he's been saying quite recently, but I mean, I just got rid of energy-based models to go to autoregressive models, so I don't know. It's hard to know what to believe. Question? Online?
Are you able to expand on the implications of assuming that on the non-MCMC side, which I believe is the tractable models, the assumption of that you can break down into products So what is the implication?
I'm gradually expanding on it over the next two lectures, yeah. So I will, this is in many senses, I'm kind of summarizing the next two lectures. So I'll get into it.
Thanks.
But you were saying that there's this problem of training the intractable models. So is there some notion of phase transition? So then for energy-based models, there's this E up. Right? So my understanding is, to do this, the underlying way of producing these samples is from some Hamiltonian or some physics-based model that has some parameters in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're saying that the training so slows that. Typically, I think MCMC training slows or sampling slows down at phase transitions, right? It's where everything becomes like super hard.
Right.
Is there a relation that do such phase transitions show up in data? Is it known that?
That's not the primary concern, but it is a concern. So typically, I think you would imagine the data you're training isn't critical, although maybe it is if you're dealing with some natural systems. So then the autocorrelation time, if I measure the autocorrelation time of a sample at time zero and time t, or some estimator, typically this thing decays as a function of time exponentially. But if you're at a phase transition, it can be some algebraic decay. And so it gets way, way, way worse. This is critical slowing down at phase transitions, yeah, for sure. But even in the case where you have an exponential decay of autocorrelations, this is still a constant. The autocorrelation time could still be 10,000 samples or 100,000 samples. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not the primary concern.
Nobody knows. But for me, the primary concern isn't that we have some sort of, you know, power law decay or, you know, if you're in a glassy system, this thing could just stay at one, right? if all of your samples are rejected and you have no ergodicity, then your autocorrelation would be stuck at one. Whereas if you have a glassy system, and people here explore it, like Estelle, then if you have perfect autoregressive sampling, no problem. You could in principle, sample glassy configurations with no slowing down. So we'll get into that. I think Estelle, hopefully, will talk about some of that too. More questions? I'm going to set up the kind of problem for density or likelihood estimation on the RBM, and then we'll take it from there next lecture. So,
quick question: Did I understand right that you associated ergodicity with the tractable models, was it with the untractable?
An intractable model can lose ergodicity.
Uh-huh.
Whereas in a tractable model, there's no concept of ergodicity of sampling. There may be another concept of ergodicity loss in learning, but that's a separate problem.
Yes.
Learning parameters could be a glassy landscape. So we'll talk about all these things. I think it's time to put it in concrete, you know what I mean? I've been saying sort of qualitative features. So let's do density estimation. On energy-based models and derive or motivate, if you will, the RBM. So really given a set of data, I've already written a data vector. So I have a set of data vectors. And let's just think of data coming from a binary state. And this is relevant for projective measurements from a qubit, right? If I measure a qubit, I get h bar over whatever 2 up or minus h bar over 2 or something like that. That's my binary data, okay? So if I have n qubits, then a single data vector x1, x2, x3, xn. So think, you know, n qubits. Right? So one projective measurement of a quantum computer produces me one data vector x. And that data vector has, n binary elements in it. And so then we have a set of those, so the data set, which I'm calling D, is the set of all the vectors that come out of the machine. I don't know what I'm drawing here. It's something like, x, I don't know how not to use subscripts here. Maybe 1, x2, so the vector, right? And each one of these is a measurement up to, the size of the data set. So, e.g., I keep saying concrete numbers, say 10,000 shots or something like that. A shot would be like one projective measurement of a quantum computing state. And because I'm only dealing with classical probability distributions for now, I'm not worried about the fact that you have to have different bases and things like that. Okay, I'm just reconstructing a probability distribution. Maybe it's a Born distribution or something like that. Every shot that comes out of the quantum computer is a vector, and there's a set of vectors, which is my data set. Okay, and these are drawn, we're going to assume, from a IID. So they're drawn independently from an unknown distribution. Probability distribution function, big P of X, which we may also call the quote unquote target distribution. So in our generative modeling setting, what we're doing is we're trying to learn, right, a parameterized model for this distribution given only this data set. That's it. That's all we got. So that's the basic setting of all generative modeling. So again, you can form your model based on inductive bias that you might want to bake into it. Like, I know I have a Gaussian, or I know I have area law entanglement. But generally, that's the only kind of prior you're going to have here. So I think, first of all, it's striking that you can even do some sort of reconstruction of a probability distribution with only binarized data. So generative modeling, discover P lambda x that best approximates the target distribution, then also generalize as well. And then what we're going to do is we're going to actually use the generative model to do two things. You can, if you have this, then use is calculate the likelihood of X. For new X, something that's outside of the data set that hasn't been seen, but also to produce new samples from P lambda x, if you will. So then with those samples, you can imagine calculating things like physical estimators and stuff like that. So the most basic generative model is very much just the energy-based model that I wrote on the board. And it was introduced by John Hopfield in 1982. And John's still around and working hard. And, you know, it's interesting to note that he's a condensed matter physicist, amongst many other hats. But you'll see a lot of condensed matter or statistical mechanics in his model. So his basic model is composed of a number of neurons. So here my n equals 5, and that's the same n as the number of qubits. And each qubit is connected, so it's a fully connected system, by a number of weights. So if I have I and j, weight I, j, okay, we can define an energy, right, of an input configuration. So now x is counting, you know, it's ups and downs, or zeros and ones typically. So xi equals 0, 1. Okay, and the energy of the Hopfield network is each weight, you know, xi, xj. So the weights, you know, are typically drawn from real numbers. Okay, and when you, I write this, you're saying, you say that's an Ising model, and it very much is. It's a fully connected Ising model. The convention is the Ising spins are labeled 0 or 1. The interaction between the spins, right, is the weights. Those are the parameters you're going to learn. So weights are your parameters, lambda. So in our notation. And then the model distribution, P of lambda x, is just 1 over z e to the minus e. I could call this, you know, sometimes I'll label this with lambda just to distinguish, you know, the fact that the model lies here. And so that's it, your first generative model. It's kind of underwhelming if you stare at it too much. But it's actually a very important conceptual, you know, I think, structure for models. It's the idea that you have adjustable parameters. In this case, the number of parameters is fixed, you know, and you can ask whether or not that makes a lot of sense to fix the number of parameters. It's not like a typical neural network that we might imagine, you know, but it very much explicitly defines a probability distribution, right? It's an explicit representation of a probability distribution. But you don't know the partition function, so it, at first blush, is clearly intractable, okay? So that's where it falls in Ian Goodfellow's taxonomy, essentially. So maybe one more board, then we can break for lunch. So the Hopfield model, which was a model of what they call associative memory in the 80s, it's still well studied today. I was down in Rutgers for their famous StatMech conference. Baskaran, do you ever go to that? The Rutgers StatMech conference? It's remarkable, right? All the who's who of...
Joel.
Yeah, Joel, yeah, he was running it. And so I was amazed because Hopfield had a postdoc who basically talked about modern uses for Hopfield networks at that StatMech conference. So, I mean, they're very much in play still in the machine learning literature. But they do have some downsides, and I'm not even going to talk about the Hop. I just want to, it's there to motivate energy-based models, but downsides of using these things as kind of generic models is the representational capacity. You have a fixed number of weights, and you know these weights are difficult to train. Let's say hard to train. So they kind of violate a couple of our requirements for good generative models, but like I say, look at some of the more recent work coming out of people who are still working with Hopfield on these things. So in particular, Hopfield's on this paper, and so is Dmitry Krotov, who is actually at IBM. So IBM proper has a still has a fairly active effort on hop field models. Hard to train, and you know they're intractable. That's another point because of the trace. So I'm going to come back to the trace in this class several times, but the trace. Oh, I didn't define the partition function. Okay, so Z, you know, I'm going to write it like this: is the trace over e to the, you know, e to the energy, the standard thing. And just keep in mind that when I define this, it's kind of a symbolic definition. That is the product of all sums for all xi's which lie in the set of 0 or 1, right? So it's really product x1, oh sorry, sum x1, sum x2, all the way up to xn. Okay, and that's the intractable part of the energy-based models, you know, based on Hopfield. So again, one hypothesis is that this intractability, you know, leads to things like particularly difficulty for training and things like that. But another, again, downfall of the Hopfield model is that you're just stuck with those same number of weights. And so if I wanted something that was systematically more expressive, you know, if I wanted to add more weights to this thing, I can imagine just adding more binary units and connecting them, but then, you know, they would have to be outside of the physical space. So if I wanted to represent 10 qubits, the Hopfield model is what it is. I can't, you know, add more qubits to my data set if I don't have more qubits. But I could add what's called a latent or a hidden space. And that's the basic idea besides the Boltzmann machine. Which was invented by various people in the mid-80s. I think Bengio had something to do with it too. But the most famous papers were in 1985-ish, 1986, and included Jeff Hinton. So the RBM, or the Boltzmann machine, is very much one of Jeff Hinton's babies, invented, I think, at the University of Toronto. And Jeff Hinton, of course, is famous now because, you know, he followed this path that we're going to kind of explore in the next week, became very much involved, and his students became involved in large language models, and now, you know, Jeff is speaking out against training these models and their implication for society and so on. But, you know, again, in the 80s, he very much contributed to the thinking behind all these generative models. So what is a Boltzmann machine? I take my Hopfield network, and I'm going to lay it out. N equals 5. I have all these connections, but I have, you know, all possible connections. Gets messy, whatever. I won't draw them all. But now I add an additional layer, like a hidden layer. So this is sometimes called visible. And this is called hidden. And the hidden layer I also connect with weights. So every hidden unit in the hidden layer connects with the visible layer and, you know, with itself. So I'll break my X into V's and H's, and my H's, each one of my H's and each one of my V's is still binary, 0 or 1. So that's the basic Boltzmann machine. And the Boltzmann machine has one big advantage over Hopfield networks as a generative model, in that it's systematically improvable. So although the visible unit number is fixed, it's at n equals 5 for my 5-qubit quantum computer, the number of hidden units can be anything you want. It could be 1, it could be a million. And as you add, you know, more and more weights to the Hamiltonian there, you basically see how you can express more and more complex probability distributions. So the restricted Boltzmann machine, unfortunately, has some downsides, which I won't get into. But those were largely alleviated by just the last architecture I'm going to put on here, and we'll start with this next class, the restricted Boltzmann machine. Which was, again, pioneered by Hinton. Basically in the 80s. And the idea with the restricted Boltzmann machine is just to take the Boltzmann machine and remove the intralayer weights. Okay, so this is what we'll start with next time. Here's my visible units, V. Here's my hidden units, H. And the architecture of this machine is that I'm only connecting visibles to hiddens with no intra-layer weights, okay? So I'll talk again. We'll start with this. These are in hiddens. Oh, I have it here. Here's H3. Here's V3. Here's V4. Right. Each one of those is binary. I'll show why we remove the intra-layer weights. It has to do with the tractability of calculating the cost function, which I'll introduce next time. Okay. But it's a very interesting architecture for many reasons. First off, you've eliminated the direct qubit-to-qubit correlations, if you will, or weights, but you've replaced them with a mediation through an external or hidden or latent space, very much like a Hubbard-Stratonovitz transformation in some sense for the physicists. So it's actually a generalized Hubbard-Stratonovitz transformation, certainly. And so you may need more hidden units in an RBM than in a Boltzmann machine, but there's a really important payoff there. So I think it's a very nice architecture. We're going to dive deep into it in the next lecture. We're going to calculate the loss function, so how we train the thing through gradient descent. With that, you'll see why it's important to remove the restrictions. And I think it's a nice springboard into Wednesday's topic, which will be our first autoregressive model, okay? And that'll lead into Mohammed's lectures. Okay, so that's it for today. Any questions before we break for lunch?
So this also starts looking like tensor networks. They're restricted.
There's been a huge body of study mapping these to tensor networks by now, right? So one, you restrict it, but in the limit of, unlimited hidden units, you can actually prove that these things can capture volume law entanglement. So they're in some sense maybe more general than a tensor network, but it doesn't say anything about whether or not you can actually optimize the weights and so on. So RBMs, again, very important since our field started looking at them probably 2016-ish, something like that. Give you a nice physical intuition and not just for the architecture, but also, again, to compare to more established methods like tensor networks. Certainly we'll explore that going forward.
I mean, there is a connection, like string bond states are the RBM is like a special case of a string bond state, which mm-hmm. is like you can view this as a generalization of an MPS structure, right? Instead of having one MPS that covers the lattice, you have multiple that carry an index. It's much more complicated than just an MPS.
Right, yeah, so it looks very general, of course, and I would say, yes, there has been a lot of study that shows that these things are more expressive in some settings. They're universal approximators for probability distributions in the limit of taking as many hidden units as you want. But that doesn't mean they're easy. There's are good heuristics for learning on them. And so again, we're separating out maybe those four elements: good expressive representational capacity, good learning heuristics, the ability to calculate things on them, and I forget the fourth one. More questions?
Roger, the Ian Goodfellow's taxonomy review I'm not sure if you put the archive number on the blackboard because I couldn't see it. Do you happen to have which year or?
I'll put it right here.
He has so many papers.
1701-00160.
Oh, you're a star. Thank you. Bon appétit.
Okay. Thank you very much, and see you all tomorrow.